Well, it's really great to be with you this evening. Thank you very much for the invitation and for the welcome. And thank you to Danny for leading us and for his recollection of a number of years of friendship. But he said he wouldn't emphasize the old friends. And then he brings me up now the last hymn, which is in larger print. I mean, I had it anyway in normal print, but thanks. That's cool. I'm really pleased. Thank you very much. We're going to turn to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 13, and we're going to look at a couple of those parables that we just heard read to us. Matthew 13, page 819, if you're using a church Bible, and verses 44 through to 46. Matthew 13, 44 to 46. I'll just read them again for us. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it. Jesus teaching in parables, and maybe sometimes we think that's really helpful, and it'd be great if preachers did that more often, told stories that an illustration that helped us to get the truth of what God's word is saying. That's indeed a good thing. It's not actually what the parables are for. Back in the first part here of Matthew 13, Jesus says actually it's to test people to see whether their hearts are in the right place, whether they really want to know the truth. Because it wasn't so obvious to his listeners, nor to the disciples, what he meant by what he said in the parables. So if they were simply illustrations, he wasn't very good at it. But he was saying, no, in a sense, I'm saying it because I want you to say, so what does that mean? And to really try and work through its meaning and its significance for them. And he's speaking about God's kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, speaking about how things work when God is king, how things work, in a sense, when heaven and earth combine in the work of Jesus, what he's come to do. And sometimes, well, when you move from one place to another in life, it can be quite confusing. My wife's uncle, one of her uncles, the only living uncle possibly, is currently moving from Guernsey to Pontefract. You never thought Ponty was that cool, did you? And that you would leave somewhere where you've got access to the sand and the sea and the sun and so on. But, well, for various reasons, he's in process of doing that. My wife's mum, my mother-in-law, she lives just down the road from us. You can be there in 5, 6, 7 minutes walk. Just throwing that detail in to try and get some sympathy from you. But anyway, she is there, and she's his sister, and so he's moving over to be nearer to her. She's mid-80s, he's early 80s. But I tell you what, moving from Guernsey, it's part of the UK, sort of. I don't know what the official way of looking at it is, but our dear Channel Islands, Winston Churchill said. You would imagine moving from Guernsey to Yorkshire would be straightforward in terms of administration and that kind of stuff. But I tell you what, it isn't. It's really tricky. He's got a mobile phone, sort of a Doro. If you've got a Doro, they're great. I'm not dissing Doros, but the SIM card in it is a Tesco SIM. And he said, it's costing me a fortune phoning people back in the island. Well, we'll just go down to Tesco and we'll tell them, look, he's on the mainland now. You don't have to charge him 88 pence a minute or whatever it is. But you go to the Tesco store, no, sorry, we can't do anything with that because you're moving from Guernsey over here. You know, it's a really big thing. And it can be in even bigger ways, moving from one culture to another. The mistakes that you make and how difficult it is to get your mind around things. Jesus here is talking about the biggest change anyone could ever know, coming out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, coming under the reign of the one true God, and who he is and how he is and how he engages with people. And Jesus especially is talking about what's happening through him as God's son, as the Messiah, the one who brings in that kingdom. He wants us to understand, and these parables, they're great for helping us in all sorts of ways with respect to that. What's the operating system, if you like, of God's kingdom, and what motivates him, and how does he work? Well, in that context, what about these couple of little parables? There's a few small little parables in this chapter, aren't there? We heard four of the smaller ones being read, but these two in particular, what are they saying? Well, just to sort of expand the evening, let me tell you how I used to think about these parables before coming on to how do I think about these parables, and how, if I can suggest, how we all ought to think of these parables. I used to look at these and think, right, it's saying God is the greatest treasure we can have, and you've got to put all other things aside to get hold of him. He's like treasure hidden in a field. You find it, you cover it again because you're going home, you're getting together all that you've got because you want it. And Jesus says, you know, you've got to take up your cross and follow him. And if you want to hold on to your life, you're going to lose it. But if you're prepared to lose it for his sake and for the gospel, then you'll find it. And the second parable, in a sense, amplifying that for us. It's like a merchant in search of fine pearls. He finds one of great value. He goes and sells all he has and buys it. And it's about us and our commitment to finding God and living for him and putting other things aside. I think the Bible teaches those things in different places and in different ways. But was looking at this again for various reasons recently, and someone's suggestion made me stop and think, maybe I got that wrong. Maybe that's not what it's saying. And the more I looked at it and thought about it, the more it seemed to me, actually, yeah, that small suggestion is a really helpful thing for how we ought to see this. So how should we see these parables? I'll just say it and then we'll try and work through it. The kingdom of heaven's like treasure hidden in a field, which a man finds, covers up in his joy, sells all he has, buys the field. Same with the merchant seeking fine pearls, finds one of great value, the best value, the highest value, goes and sells all he has and buys it. Who's the man who finds the treasure? Who's the merchant looking for the pearl? Who sells everything in order to lay hold of the treasure and the pearl? My suggestion to you tonight is it's God himself. And it's Jesus who's being spoken of in these two parables. And that makes those he finds treasure and of inestimable value to him. His people, those whom he seeks and saves, those whom he rescues. Is that the right way to see it? It's a bit like, I was racking my brains. I'm not very good on perfumes and that kind of thing, but I was just sat there thinking, it's a bit like that advert that says, because you're worth it. And I thought, but what was that an advert for? You know, you remember the ad, or you remember the strapline. I can't remember. It was some kind of, was it perfume? Because you're worth it. Does that...
Shampoo.
Shampoo. Danny, you and I have got no interest in shampoo. I don't think it was shampoo. Was it a perfume or something like that? L'Oreal. Brilliant. Thank you very much. I knew someone would know. L'Oreal. Is that really expensive, or are they just trying to con us? Anyway, L'Oreal. Because you're worth it. It sounds like that, doesn't it? When you immediately think in these terms, I'm treasure. You know, it sounds like you've wandered into an episode of Oprah Winfrey, perhaps, and that kind of... You know, we've got to think that we're worth it. Is that what I'm trying to say? Well, I kind of am, sort of. But we need to back up a little bit, because I don't think that would sit very easily with us for all sorts of reasons. Let me just go through the reasons why we might find this really hard to accept in those terms, and then we'll work through... in Bible terms, why we should actually think of it like that. But why might it not sit easily with us? Well, the fact is, we know the truth about ourselves. And the truth we know about ourselves, which no one else fully knows, actually we don't even know as much about ourselves as God knows. But we do know this, that we are sinful people, that we do mess up, that we're not always as honest about things as we perhaps ought to be. And all sorts of things affect that. You know, they say, don't Don't make ethical decisions in your work if you've just been doing stuff which is just very sort of motor driven, if you like, not to do with cars, but you know, very sort of mechanistic. But don't just switch straight away into something ethical, because you won't make as ethical a decision as you would have if you had gone into it in a more considered kind of manner. But we all struggle and we all fall down in all sorts of ways, and we know that we do wrong, and we want to put our hands up and say, that's true of me. And the last thing we would then want to claim for ourselves is that we are immaculate treasures, and that, you know, we're a pearl of great price. We are a wonderful example of something that someone would want to have and would want to lavish all their expenses on in order to get hold of. The fact is that we're not like that, and we know that we're not like that. That's one reason why what I've begun to say may not sit so easily with us as we begin to think about it. Another reason is this: if you're a Christian with a history in churches like ours in Ponte, yours here and so on, then your default way of thinking about yourself, is certainly not as a treasure, but what a friend of mine refers to as a DRS. Well, that's the decision review system in cricket, isn't it? The DRS, he doesn't mean that. Dirty, rotten sinners. And that's a default way of thinking for many of us, and for many of churches like ours, like yours here, and the way that we might approach the Bible. So for someone to say, but no, you're not, you're a treasure, there's an immediate clash there, and for all sorts of reasons. And if we were to say, no, I've got to think in that new way, doesn't it immediately feel unspiritual and arrogant that we should make such claims about ourselves? And maybe a third reason why it doesn't sit easily, it sounds too simple on one level, and it doesn't sound very biblical. A third reason for thinking and feeling that is our own personalities, maybe forged in all sorts of contexts, are crying out, no, you see, that's not me. I am a nobody, and I know I'm a nobody. And for all sorts of reasons, I know that's the case. And for all sorts of reasons, I am now who I am, and in terms of upbringing or friends or life circumstances or genetics, whatever it is that makes me who I am, I know it's not true. I'm not treasure. I'm actually worth less. And I'm not significant. And no one should ever, ever give everything they've got in order to make me precious to them, or to demonstrate that I'm precious to them. So for all sorts of reasons, it may not sit very easily with us. We're not used to thinking in those terms. It goes against our personality in all sorts of ways. It goes against the fact of the situation we do wrong. Now, for all of those reasons, it kind of does feel like it's going to be an uphill task to gain any traction for this different way of reading these parables. But actually, what I think is true of you as a church and as God's people here is that you're like those dudes in Berea. They did call them dudes back then, who, when Paul went there, checked what he said against the Bible. So if there is to be any substantial reason for changing how we might think, if you did think like I thought about these parables, it's got to be based on what the Bible itself says. Otherwise, we are just making stuff up and going with what might feel nice for us. So, in Bible terms, why understand these parables as it's God, it's Jesus, who's the man who finds the treasure, the merchant seeking the fine pearl, and it's we who are the treasure and that pearl of inestimable value? What Bible reasons are there for thinking in those terms? Well, first of all, in Matthew's gospel, all the kingdom parables that Jesus tells, he tells several. There's several here in Matthew 13. We could go on into chapter 18, chapter 20, 21, 22, 24 and 25. And there are multiple parables of the kingdom. Every parable of the kingdom of heaven that Jesus tells in Matthew's gospel that has a single main actor or character in it, that single main actor or character is God himself. Or is Jesus himself speaking about his ministry without exception? I could work our way through them if you want. I guess we haven't got that much time to do that. So if you want, go home later, check it up. If you've got a phone and a program on it, maybe Olive Tree, something like that, just use the search bar and go in, find all the instances of Kingdom of Heaven in Matthew, and I think you'll find that's the case. Every single parable he tells, where there is a single or main character or actor in it, that person, that character, is the work of, it's God, it's his work, it's Jesus, it's his work. So it would be extremely unusual, unexpected, odd even, for these two parables to take a different tack in terms of that one main character or actor, without there being anything in the context to suggest we need to change how we're thinking, guys. Because all that Jesus has taught so far is the person, the main person who is acting here, the main character in this story, it's about God himself. And you can trace that through in chapter 13 and then all those other chapters that I've mentioned. And I would say there's nothing here to suggest that he's changing tack, that there is a different approach being taken. It's quite consistent all the way through. And in a sense, there is a momentum that Jesus is building up here in what he's saying. It is layer upon layer upon layer of how God works, who God is, what his kingdom is like. So no, the context, immediate context, chapter 13, the bigger context of Matthew's gospel, in fact the other gospels as well, in terms of the parables that Jesus tells, say to us, no, there seems to be good contextual reason for thinking that actually this person who finds the treasure and the merchant seeking the fine pearl, the main character, the main actor in the parables, might actually be God himself. But we've got those instinctive objections. How do we deal with those? Is there anything in the larger Bible picture that helps us with that? Well, what is the larger reality? Just to stay with the details of these parables for a moment, is it such a stretch to move from a man finding treasure in a field, covering it, goes and sells all that he has to buy that field, and the same with the merchant? Is it such a stretch to think that here is someone who, okay, we'll deal with what he values in a moment or two, but is it so unusual in terms of the Bible story, the gospel storyline, to think that God has given everything for something, for someone, for a people? Isn't it actually the heart of the gospel? Isn't it what we've just been singing about and delighting in? That God so loves us, he hasn't spared his own son, but he gave him up for us, for us all, and with him he'll freely give us all things. The great climax of Jesus' life on earth is dying upon the cross. What's it all about? Well, we would be very quick to say it's not just an example of love that we then need to follow. There is something deeper, something better going on there. It's about rescue. It's about substitution. It's about God's best being given for us, that we might be rescued. When Jesus was dealing with Zacchaeus in Luke 19, he speaks something there which is so familiar perhaps to you if you're a Christian this evening, that the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. And he's coming and seeking and saving by giving himself. The Apostle Paul speaks about the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. The love of God demonstrated, expressed in the non-withholding of his Son. He gives everything. Jesus goes to depths we cannot imagine, we cannot express. Everything is given. The life of Jesus is given for us. So that larger gospel context, when you read these parables, well, maybe it's not so far-fetched to begin thinking in those terms, that the main character, the main actor in the story, gives everything in order to make what was lost to be found, and to find something that he will then treasure. He has paid the highest price. That is the astonishing love of God for us. But maybe the hardest thing that we find in thinking about, is the treasure me? Is it us? Am I? Are we this pearl of great price? It's to do with, well, I know that I sin. And I know that that's how I've come into this world. And I know that's what my life has been. I know that's what my thoughts have been, as well as my actions. And I know that even as a Christian now, there's so much that's so mixed up, that is so broken, that is so contradictory. We say one thing, we do another. We do one thing, we say another. We feel one thing, we think one thing, and we do it differently to it. Surely it is impossible for God to actually delight in people like us. Maybe that's the hardest part of all this. That he could tolerate us, but never treasure us, surely. Not really cherish, in the kind of way that the man who finds the field or the merchant seeking fine pearls clearly so treasures, so values, so delights in. Well, we know it's in his heart to deliver people like us. That's what he does. That's what he's like. He's compassionate. Deliver, yes, but delight? Is that real? Is that true? Do you struggle to think that that might be so for you as an individual, for us as a people? Is that what the Bible says concerning him? Well, do you know what? It says it again and again and again in ways that if we put them all together begin to take our breath away. It's that lovely book in the Old Testament. We never quite know what to do with it. The Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs. And is it allegory? Is it a type? My own thought is it's probably the story of Israel being told in a kind of narrative typology. But anyway, let's leave that to one side for a minute. That the male character in there, and he has such great love for the one he is setting his affection upon, she has much more of a realistic view of herself, we might say. She says in the first chapter, I am very dark but lovely. And she says, I've been out in the field, you know, and I've been working, and I'm not what anyone would want. I think I'm lovely, but it's so different. Well, how does he see her? And this is, in a sense, God speaking of himself in reference to his people. He says, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves. There isn't anything there of any sense that, well, I ought to say that because it's kind of expected of me, but I think it, but I don't feel it, or I ought to feel it, but I don't. There's just a spontaneous expression of real delight, of real love. And that book is meant to say to us, lift your eyes to God's relationship with his people. There's a lovely wedding psalm in the book of Psalms. Danny read from Psalm 145 and Psalm 45. There's a lovely expression of a wedding ceremony, if you like, or a wedding relationship. And again, it's meant to lift our eyes. Hebrews chapter 1 tells us it's about Jesus, and it's about him being the king and his people being his bride. Well, there are some words expressed here to the wife, the one who's becoming the wife. Hear, O daughter, consider and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house. Those things now are in the past. Something new is taking place. You're into a new relationship. Forget your people and your father's house. The king will desire your beauty. The king will desire your beauty. He will long for you. And he will love you. Zechariah chapter 2 in the Old Testament, the Lord speaks of his people as, anyone who touches you touches the apple of my eye. You are so precious to me. You are so valuable to me. I'm so enthralled, in a sense, by you. And then there are amazing words in a book that we perhaps don't go to so often amongst the minor prophets of Zephaniah. Perhaps you're aware of these verses. They have become a little bit of a hit in the Christian charts, as it were, of verses in the last decade or so, but rightly so. The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness, and he will quiet you by his love, and he will exult over you with loud singing. Well, surely he must be doing a Nelson in the Battle of Trafalgar. You know, I see no ships, I see no sins. He must be pretending. God doesn't pretend. He doesn't fake it. He means it. He will rejoice over you with gladness, quiet you by his love, and exult over you with loud singing. It's saying, in the words of our parables, he will treat you as though he has just found the pearl of greatest price. He will delight over you as a man delights over treasure that he finds in a field. And just one more instance, in a sense, in the Bible of us finding that kind of thing being spoken of. Ephesians 5, Paul speaks to wives and husbands about their relationship together. And then he says, but you know, there's a higher dimension to this. There's a mystery about this. The mystery is profound. And I'm saying, he says, it refers to Christ and the church. But what is it, what he says to husbands? Wants them to love their wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we're members of his body. Nourishes, cherishes. That's what it says. That's what God says to us, is his thoughts, his feelings, his heart toward his people. Is it so far-fetched to think that actually what he says is, you're treasure to me. You are like a pearl of great value, not just individually, but collectively as well. I think that fits right in with all those other expressions of delight and of cherishing, truly cherishing and nourishing and loving freely, wonderfully. You know, there's an interesting corollary to this, if you like, goes with this, as to how the New Testament speaks of Christians. If someone asked you, how would you describe yourself as a Christian? I guess one of the most popular answers to that would be, especially if you were given a list of options, because otherwise we might just be scratching our head, but I think what would probably come near to the top, if not the top, is, I'm a forgiven sinner. But we probably emphasize the sin a bit, because, you know, the DRS sort of stuff. Here's some homework for you. Read the New Testament. Find how many times it calls a Christian a sinner, defines a Christian in that way. Actually, England are playing football later on, aren't they? So I'll scrap the homework. I'll give you the answer. It's a big fat naught. There's only one possible case. It's when Paul says, God's had mercy on me, the chief of sinners, but he's looking backwards at that point. Do you know how the New Testament does speak of Christians, how it describes and defines us? Well, think of all the letters where the Apostle Paul writes to the saints in God's holy people. Not holy because of practice. It's talking there about belonging to him, loved by him, cherished by him, in his family, members of the body of Christ, holy and dearly loved. And that is again and again and again and again and again. But our vocabulary and our self-vocabulary so rarely matches the Bible. If he doesn't describe you in that way, and if he doesn't think of you in that way, what business is it of yours to do the opposite? It feels like a challenge that I'm throwing out to you. It is a challenge, really. Because if he's your Lord, it's up to him to choose how we are defined and how we're spoken of and how we are thought of. And how we think of ourselves and self-speak about ourselves makes a huge difference in how we worship him, in how we live for him, in how we witness, and in how we deal with his creation and with people who are made in his image and likeness. I think these parables are saying to us, at least in part, we need to revise how we think of him and how we think of his love for us. And for some of us, this will be a huge challenge. Clearly, I'm not saying to us, we all need to leave here this evening and go away saying, do you know what, I always knew it. It's just that no one had ever discovered that I was this great treasure. That you know, I am what the world has been waiting for. Clearly, that's not what we're saying. And that's not what he is saying to us. But there will be very few of us, I guess, who will be thinking in those terms. I guess this is something that most of us wrestle with at one time or another, about how am I seen by him? Am I actually an embarrassment to him? And I am tolerated within his family, but I'm not really delighted in. Maybe you've experienced that in life, within your family, in your school days, maybe in your workplace or college, whatever it is. That people have let you know in one way or another that, oh, okay, we're not going to kick you out, but we don't really enjoy having you around. I think many of us, at times, if not in an ongoing way, struggle with that in terms of being in God's family. That I'm there because of grace, and I'm there freely, it was his choice, but he kind of half made it with one hand behind his back, because that's his character. And I haven't really impressed him. I've given him nothing really to delight in. And I am the kind of person who, you know, if someone came to visit, it'd make sure I had some job to do in the garden so that they didn't see me. In your reading of the Bible, I want to encourage you to ask yourself the question, is that really what it says? Is that really his heart towards me? Or actually, is his heart more revealed in these parables and in those host of other places that we've been this evening? Do I need to revise how I think of him and his relationship with me and how he sees me? Because if I am kind of just tolerated and if I am a bit of an embarrassment, there isn't there the kind of freedom the New Testament speaks about. It's for freedom that Christ has set us free. The freedom of being adopted children of God, dearly loved. And when I know I am dearly loved and not just tolerated within the family, the freedom that comes with that is to live for his praise and his honour without feeling I've got to somehow impress him because he never did like me all that much and I've got to get him on side or more on side than he has been already. And there is no freedom there. I am always chewed up. But Jesus sets people free, really, truly, permanently free. So maybe the challenge is I need to revise my thinking about him and me, and then I need to allow that to change how I see and respond to others as well. Because if it is remarkably, wonderfully true about me, then it is also true about others. Those who have not yet been rescued, not yet been saved, And we love to see people rescued and saved and becoming Christians. But there are some people that, well, we wouldn't say we don't want to see them as Christians. But what we think is, well, if the Lord does save them, I hope he changes them really, really quick. Because to be honest, they really get up my nose. You can walk through Pontic. I guess it would be the same would be true in Leeds. You walk downtown in an evening, doesn't have to be very late into the evening. You see a guy taking a wee next to a shop. And you think, why? Why are you behaving like an animal? I know in different countries they have different rules about that kind of thing, but... And you think, I don't like you. Your instinctive response, perhaps. Or the way that you hear someone talk to someone else. Maybe you're walking down the street, and it's a mum with her children. And she's being so harsh with them. And we don't then make the mental calculation, well, actually, that probably a lot of that happened in her own childhood. And maybe there are bad things going on at the moment and so on. We just look and think, oh, get a grip, woman, please. And we don't see the guy who's relieving himself against the shop, or the mum who's just lost it with her kids. We don't see them as treasures, pearls of inestimable value. And it's easier for us to do that because actually we're this side of the line now. And we can start making a little bit of a harder line than it was when we came across it. A bit more of a firmer border, perhaps. But the love that melts our heart, God's love that declares us his treasure and a pearl for which he has given everything. When we taste and see that he is good in those terms, it must change, mustn't it? How we speak to each other, how we welcome each other, how we endure with one another, how we see and welcome and endure with those who are not here this evening, who are not yet in God's kingdom. Does it not begin to change everything? I think it must do, because it is about being set free through the love of the Father to be his dearly loved children, welcomed, embraced, not an embarrassment, not just tolerated, but he wants us in his kingdom, in his family, and gave everything, everything, that might be so. Well, we're going to sing a lovely song to close. Stay standing then, and I'll pray to close our time together. Speaks of Jesus being the lover of our souls. Speaks about us finding a refuge in him. Finding that he will cover our defenseless head with a shadow of his wing, and finding great treasure in him, even as he esteems us as his great treasure. Well, we'll stand and sing, Jesus, lover of my soul.